Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and it's a great pleasure again and an honor to speak to the best audience on earth, people concerned about the well-being of other human beings, people who help other beings, support other human beings, fight for the rights of other human beings, try to provide them services that are better than, well, it's not hard to be better than, but services that are better than drugs, electroshock, and God forbid, psychosurgery. It's one of the great things of my life that once every week I get to talk to you and have been doing so for too many years now to count. And today is going to be a breath of fresh air day about what's really good and positive here on Earth. Peg, are you there?
I am.
Well, Peg is there. Before I introduce you to her, I want to go to the dark side for a minute. Something's been really on my mind a lot lately. I'm writing a book chapter about it for a collection of critical psychiatry chapters. I'm just seeing more and more children and, of course, adults with tardive dyskinesia, this terrible disorder that strikes any muscle that you have partial or complete control over, obviously the hands and feet and fingers and toes and your smile, your mouth, your tongue, eyes can blink, face grimaces, limbs go off on their own, basically. It can affect speech and breathing and swallowing. Imagine just something simple like terrible teeth grinding that goes on for the rest of your life so that you lose teeth, you have pain all the time in your mouth and in your muscles of your mouth, and you bite your tongue. And that's not even the worst case. And we have cases of the dystonic or dystonia form of it where people's bodies just tense up all the time. Sometimes, well, very commonly, the neck distorts, so-called cervical dystonia, and you're bent forward all the time. One of my legal cases, I have an elderly woman whose head is buried in her chest to the right side of her body. Younger people, too, get afflicted with this. And then we have tardive akathisia, where people feel like they're being tortured from the inside out, and they have to pace around all the time and keep moving. In the state mental hospitals, there are people who wear out their shoes, and even at home will literally wear out their shoes because when they're sitting, they're always moving them. And this disorder goes along with cognitive impairments, and extreme cases, dementia, and it goes along with a worsening or the first-time experience of psychosis. This is a plague, and it affects people with the newest drugs as well as the older ones. Drug companies lied when they promoted this as these new drugs, new antipsychotic drugs that caused them, when they claimed that these would less likely or to cause tardive dyskinesia or might not at all. Drugs like Abilify and Fanapt and Geodone and Vega, Latuda, Risperdal, Safra, Seroquel, Zyprexa. I'm seeing TD cases in my clinical and legal practice that from all of those drugs that I've mentioned to you, this is really a dreadful situation. And one of the worst offenders is Risperidone. It was the product of, it is the product of J&J, Johnson & Johnson. And Johnson & Johnson paid, I think, over $2 billion to the Justice Department for off-label marketing of this drug and part labeling pushing it for children and pushing it for the elderly. And a large majority of my cases appear to be, as I'm trying to look them over, related to Risperdal and orphan children and the elderly. And that shows you the success of off-label marketing and why $2 billion may not just be enough when to pay in compensation when you're making probably a lot more from that same off-label marketing. So I just wanted you to catch up on a little of what I'm doing. I'm doing a lot of legal work, as always, and I'm doing a large number of tardive dyskinesia cases. My most recent one that went to court was a child, went to trial where I testified, the most recent one I testified in. You can see it on my website. It was a $1.5 million verdict for a child involving Risperdal and also Zyprexa. So I just wanted to give you just a little update on what I'm doing on the dark side. Someday I'll let you all know just how difficult that work is. The other side doesn't take it lightly when you do this kind of work. Now for the brighter side. Peg. Peg Haust-Arliss. Am I saying Haust right?
Yeah, close enough. Haust-Arliss.
Haust-Arliss. Mm-hmm. Peg, I met Peg in my office when I provided some space for Gary Null to do a film. Gary was doing a film here in town, and Gary is the owner of Progressive Radio Network. And I so appreciate Gary that when he lost his space for filming one of his upcoming films, I invited him to do it right in my office, and I got to meet the most interesting people who were coming for the film. And my greatest pleasure was in meeting Peg Haust-Arliss. Because she's local, she's just an enthusiastic human being and a therapist. And I'm sure she does good therapy. Her new book is Anxiety Breakthrough, Break Out of Fear, Breakthrough to Freedom. She has a quote in the book, which I thought was really good, and this must go back a long way. It's a quote from Lao Tzu. Is that pronouncing that right, Lao Tzu?
I believe so, yes.
T-Z-U. I don't know how many, does this go back hundreds or thousands of years? I don't know how far back. But the quote is, if you are depressed, you are living in the past. If you are anxious, you are living in the future. If you are at peace, you are living in the present. I think there's a huge amount of wisdom, philosophy, and therapeutic help in that. Welcome to the show. This is I think, Peg's first real interview on the radio. She's had two short appearances. And, Peg, you're not the first person that Ginger or I has met and said, you should be on the radio, who hasn't been much on before. And I don't think Peg had even heard of me before we met at my office. So welcome to the show, and, you know, talk about who you are and what you do, because you're doing a lot of interesting things.
Yeah.
And I think you can best explain them.
Thank you. Well, so I did not know that you, I did not know you before, and I was like, what a gem in the Finger Lakes that I was missing. So I'm so happy that we met. And so yes, I am a therapist, a psychotherapist in the Finger Lakes area. I am actually in Seneca Falls, and I am an anxiety specialist, and that came because of my whole story of going through anxiety myself. And now my mission is to help people really not only get over anxiety, but really to live their purpose so they can break free of limiting beliefs and fears that they may not even realize is, you know, stories they're telling themselves, and help people to break out of that and really live a purposeful life. So that's what I do, and that's what I'm passionate about. And
well,
I do holistic, by the way.
What was that?
I take a holistic approach. So that's really my forte is a holistic approach for me means not only natural, but without drugs or anything like that, of course, but looking at each segment of mind, body, and spirit. So we do some mind part. We do the psychotherapy, the traditional cognitive piece, but also much more than that. We also look at body. So there we're looking at what's going on nutritionally. Are you experiencing health conditions that are, you know, helping you to feel anxious or depressed? Are you not eating or eating things, certain things that you are affecting your moods? So it's really important to look at that. And I was noticing my clients, how I got interested in that was they were doing great work with the cognitive piece. They were, I was teaching them about the thought mood connection, and they were doing thought records, and we were doing all kinds of things mind wise, but I noticed they were still complaining about feeling sick and feeling tired and having a lot of health issues. And I thought to myself, well, man, what's the point of, you know, getting rid of anxiety and stress if you feel tired all the time and sick all the time? But I couldn't speak to them, obviously, about that because I didn't have any credential in that area. So I said, you know, I have to do something. So I went to the Institute for Integrative Nutrition and became a health coach. So at least I could speak to them about that piece of it ethically. And then that just opened up a whole big thing. And I started to learn so much and make changes in my own diet, and my sleep improved, my mood improved. And so now I make sure I incorporate that in my practice. And then the spirit part is all about, I talk about primary food, and people, what do you think of, Peter, when you think of primary food instantly? What comes to the top of your head? Probably what you eat. Primary
chocolate.
Food. Right?
Chocolate.
And so what I, what I talk about is, primary food is not what you eat. Primary food is what feeds your spirit.
Okay.
All the things you love to do, the joy, the relationships, fun, adventure, that's primary food. And secondary food is really what you put in your body. So for me, that's what a holistic approach is in a nutshell. So I don't want to talk about cognitive therapy with my client, you know, and just talk about that. I want to talk about the whole person, everything that feeds your mind, body, and spirit. So that's what I do.
Now, I noticed that you are a trained social worker, right?
Yes.
And you haven't mentioned that, which is interesting. You say you're a psychotherapist, and you say you're a trainer, and almost anybody can say that. I don't think those are legal terms. Are you avoiding saying you're a social worker for any reason? Because a lot of good therapists are social workers.
Absolutely. You know, I dabbled with that, and when I was going to college, I knew what I wanted to do right from the gate. I knew that my dream was to be a therapist. That's what I wanted. That's what I had my sights on. But I had an opportunity to either do the psychology track or the social work track. And I ended up doing both because I couldn't make up my mind. I got my bachelor's in social work and my bachelor's in psychology. So then I learned about both sides of the field. And then when it came to get my master's, I had to make a decision. Do I take the psychology track or the social work track? And I took the social work track for a couple reasons, because that's where I felt like home. I felt it fit more my personality with the whole person and, you know, the helper, the giver. I just felt at home there. And plus, also, I have to say, that's what I learned business-wise was what is going to help me become the therapist I wanted to be as far as, you know, seeing people. Because like you said, yeah, there's a lot of social workers that are therapists, and so that's what I did.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very good degree to have nowadays. I think you chose right. The psychology track with a master's degree is a pretty blind alley compared to social work. And even a psychology PhD now, I mean, I think they're having more trouble finding work than social workers. So it turned out to be, I think, a good choice for you.
Yeah,
you,
open
you
many
come
doors.
Across as just so full of life and I'm sure love as well.
Yeah.
Have you always been this way, or was that a part of your liberation from what you call in your book sort of the prison, not sort of, you call it the prison of anxiety. In fact, you have what at first confused me because I read it too fast in your dedication. You wrote, "This book is dedicated to all the inmates at Anxiety State Prison." And I didn't see the anxiety part, so I read, "All the inmates at State Prison. I can't wait to see you on the outside." and to my husband, Craig, who walked patiently, waited patiently for my freedom. Did you, like I, get liberated in part through your marriage? And did you change a lot over the years?
Well, my anxiety state prison, my prison started when I was in kindergarten. So I have always been, I tell a story in my book about how I've always been happy and go lucky and full of energy. And I was raised around a lot of animals. I lived out in the country and I was very protected that way. And my family was all loving and it was all just wonderful. And then I went to kindergarten and I talk about let the fears begin. And that's when my anxiety started in kindergarten. And it all started with show and tell. And it was a nightmare. I call it in my book a nightmare because I was all excited to show and tell my little doggy that barked at students' legs and barked. And the teacher said, "Okay, tell us where you live, and then show us what you brought." So I lived in Tyre, New York. And if you ask the people who are local in Ithaca area, Finger Lakes area, you might know Tyre, New York is spelled T-Y-R-E. And so I said Tyre, but I lived in, that's a hamlet of Seneca Falls. So most of the kids were lived in town and they were from the town of Seneca Falls. They'd never even heard of Tyre. So I said, "My name is Peggy Haas and I live in Tyre, New York." And then all of a sudden, all the kids around me in a circle started hilariously laughing. And so for me, sensitive little Peggy, I thought they were laughing at me. And that just traumatized me, literally. And from that moment, I started to shrink. I started to hide. And I was so upset about that. And then first grade came. Oh, and by the way, I wanted to go to school forever. I mean, I couldn't wait to go to school. I couldn't learn to wait to read. And so, and I didn't learn to read that day, and I was so disappointed. So first grade came, and it happened again. I was like all excited and full of life. I was going to learn to read. And I raised my hand, and I said, "I know what that says." And I said, "Go, go, go." And then everybody looked at me like I was nuts in my mind. Like, "Oh, my God, chill out," right? So then, again, I learned to hide. So when you ask me if I've always been this way, I've always been bright and shiny and full of energy. But like most of us, right, should I dare say all of us, we've had experiences where we've been taught to hide and dim our light. And so for me, kindergarten was that birth for me. And that led to public speaking phobia. And that led to not going to college. And that led to not pursuing my dream. And that led to many things that I talk about in my book, my whole story. And then I literally did not do anything because I was so in that prison. I wanted to go to school and be a therapist since the age of 17. I knew that's what I wanted to do. I knew that was my calling. I knew that was my purpose, but I'm not smart enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not capable enough. And I have this public speaking disorder, quote unquote. So how am I going to do that anyway? So when I turned 30, I went through life, had various jobs, blah, blah, blah. And then when I turned 30, that's when the nighttime dreams started to come. And I started to dream about going back to school, and I'd have those dreams periodically, but they were coming every night. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta go back to school. I was crying in the hallways of my high school in my dream. And I'm like, okay, my 30th decade, it was one of those midlife things, right? And I said, okay, it's now or never. That's it, now or never, I gotta go back to school. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I just knew I had to do it. So I did, and I still was afraid of this public speaking thing. I didn't know how I was going to, because I avoided my whole high school. I used to get zeros for tests and or public speaking events and just slide by because I wasn't going to college anyway. So I said, I'm going to college, and I did it, and I did little things incremental to make sure I wasn't going to scream and run out the the classroom. So I would take a non-credit course to start, just to see if I could sit in the room. I mean, to your listeners, this may seem, for some of them who've never experienced severe anxiety, this might sound crazy to them, like, really? But if you have some listeners that have struggled with this, I can imagine them saying, oh, I know what you're talking about, I've been there. And so it was just paralyzing to me, but I had to do it. So I ended up having a panic attack. I proved to myself that I could do it. I was excelling academically like crazy. I was getting A's, getting all kinds of academic awards, and I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. But the more I did that, the more my anxiety started. So this turned into not just public speaking. This turned into severe panic attacks now. And now it went into not being able to drive and not being able to ride at times, not at the same time, thankfully, not being able to go to the store, not being able to fly, not being able to travel, not being able to dance. And I love to dance. And so it really debilitated me. And so I didn't expect that. I just thought that I was going to have public speaking phobia like I always had, but I never thought I would experience this. And that is why I'm an anxiety specialist now, because I originally wanted to be a therapist because I wanted to help other women in domestic violence situations. That was the real reason. And so now I do that as well. But I had learned that anxiety was not really about, and I help my clients to understand this, it's not really about just your thoughts and your moods. You know, it's not just about your automatic thoughts and your core beliefs, but it's about your protective mechanism of helping you to keep safe and helping you to stay in your comfort zone. So for me, my anxiety would show up when I got too big for my britches, right? And so that little voice would say, oh, no, no. You know, you don't be too full of yourself, you know, just because you're getting A's, or it happened on my wedding day. So, oh, no, no, you know, don't be too, you know, happy about that. So every time I wanted to be myself and shine and be bright, there comes my anxiety, keeping me safe and sound. And that is why, that's the biggest aha moment I had. And now I'm like on a mission to like help people get through that, because I want people to be able to live their dreams and live a purposeful life and not have anxiety stop them in their tracks. And by the way, I could never do this. This was like, forget about it. I would never be able to sit here and talk to you on a radio show in a million years. So this is what I'm talking about. I have to really hopefully get your audience to really get that point. So long story short, right?
Did you have therapy? Well, let me just remind people who we're talking with. It's Peg Haust-Arliss, and she's LCSW, and her book is Anxiety Breakthrough. And she's in Seneca Falls, New York, which is a beautiful town on the Finger Lakes, not too far from where I live. It's worth traveling a distance to get to see her because it's a beautiful distance to travel. As you're talking, you're talking a lot about things I believe in, which is in particular the effect of childhood on us and early childhood experiences. But that's not necessarily the theme of cognitive therapy, which you've stressed. So right. Do you also do a more traditional kind of self-discovery, insight-oriented therapy where you look at the self-defeating patterns and experiences from childhood?
Yes. I want to know the person really well. I want to understand their world. So for me to understand their world, I explain to them that that's a really important piece because it helps me know who you are and how you got to here, right? Why are you sitting there with me now? Let me hear your story. But I explain to them I don't want to stay in your story because it's really helpful for me to understand your story. And it's very therapeutic to tell your story, but we don't want to live there. And we want to find the patterns. I'm looking for the patterns and the moments that I will jot down and work with to help us understand all of this. But then I help people to take those stories, take those moments, maybe change the meaning and, you know, do some other, I am also an NLP practitioner and a strategic interventionist, so I have those hats on as well. And we're going to move ahead. We're not going to stay in the past. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sure, sure. I mean, I think that most therapists who have experience end up doing a lot of different kinds of things that seem appropriate and useful at the moment. I believe that relationship with the therapist is maybe the central healing process.
Yeah.
That is having a trusting relationship with somebody who cares about you and who seems to be doing well in life.
Exactly. That I think that is why I wanted to be a therapist way back when I was 17, because I had just a sense that that was really my greatest strength. Right, because I didn't know any of these skills, you know, but my greatest strength, I always believed, was the ability to connect and to really have that therapeutic alliance and connection with my client. That just comes natural. And that is, I think, the most important and most powerful, yes.
Yeah, I think it is very much so, too. Now, you work with couples, as I do. I also work with children and their families, so it becomes a genuine family therapy. Sometimes, if they're available, I'll work with extended family, because I think the family is the root of both security and insecurity. It's just the most important factor in our lives growing up, the most important factor in terms of who we become, both in how we learn from the family and how we struggled against the family.
Mm-hmm.
You sound very positive, by the way, about your family. Do you see most of the issues for your anxiety were not family related but school related?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. I talk to everybody's different. Everybody's got seen this too, where everybody's got a different story, but sometimes there's themes. Right? So even though everybody's story is very unique, there does tend to be themes. Family is definitely at the root of a lot of it. For me, it wasn't family, though. It was more peers. So, but family is definitely very, very much, we're going to get at the root of that. But we're going to look at relationships, and I'll help them to look at relationships in a different way. And look at, for example, you work with couples. Have you ever noticed that men and women speak different languages?
Well, if the man's speaking at all, yes.
Yes. Right. Right. So one of the things I love to do is help them understand that we're talking different languages here. We got to learn how each other talk and understand. And so I help them understand that the number one thing that women need from men is to be heard and understood. And I explain to men that women need to be heard and understood because for us it's like if we don't feel heard and understood, it's like we're not loved. We don't feel loved. And it's the same for men. Men feel that too, but for women it's just extraordinarily important. And then I tell the women, and guess what? Men need to feel important, and they need to know that they can make you happy, because if they don't feel like they can make you happy, they feel unsuccessful, and they need to feel successful, and they need to feel significant in your life. And I just give them this one little tool, you know, just for a week, you know, and I coach them on how to do this specifically, but the gist of it is just for a week, really understand, really hear and understand your wife. And I go through how to do that. And I said, and just for the week, to the woman, make it easy for your man to be, you know, make you happy. And it doesn't take much. And they're always amazed at, you know, the examples I give. And it's like, oh my God, I do that all the time. And it's like, well, stop that. That's the problem. And they do this exercise for 1 week and they come back and they say, oh my gosh, that turned so much around. Just those one things, feeling loved, deeply loved and heard, and feeling appreciated. So does that, you know, do you find that with your couples that that is so important and that could heal so much pain?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's very similar to some of the things that I do with folks. I urge people to learn to not open their mouth until they've figured out how to say it, something in a way that will improve the relationship. And that, for people who are in trouble, is like an unbelievably difficult and far-fetched idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to actually see people during a couple of sessions start to open their mouths to once again hammer the same old issues and to think, oh, if I say this is definitely not going to improve the relationship and make my partner feel better. Definitely not. And I think that communication at its best is loving.
Yes.
And I try to help people learn to get what they want and to affect their partners by through loving communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very startling idea to most people because, first of all, they get very confused about communication. People often think that communication means explaining how angry you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that only freaks out the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really say, no, for me at least, communication isn't about showing how angry you are. In fact, you're doing it right now. Your husband's doing it by saying nothing and looking very, very tense. He's communicating how beleaguered and angry he feels. And you're talking very rapidly about what all the problems are, and that's expressing your anger toward him, and neither of you are connecting. And what I want to eventually do, and we will talk about problems, but I really want the goal is for you to just be chirping, loving communication at each other. And even when you're talking seriously or about serious problems, to always keep in mind we love each other, and that's how we're going to communicate. And that's a transformative idea for people.
It is. It is. And, you know, to bring that point home, I'll say, you know what, to be frank, just treat each other like it did when you first met. I mean, just, you know, treat each other with the same respect you treat a stranger, for God's sake. So I use a lot of humor in my therapy, if you haven't noticed, and I'm really laid back like that. But I'll do anything to get these points across in a way that they'll hear me, you know?
Yeah.
And that usually clicks. It's like, yeah, hello, let's treat people the way that you treat a typical stranger on the street. Treat your spouse that way.
Certainly,
and you will get
don't
far.
Be more nasty to your spouse than you would be to a stranger on the street
right.
a well-armed citizen.
Yes. And I also
try
to help
them. What I like to do, Peg, is I, very early on, and many of my clients, they come to me, they're sort of last resort. They've heard about me, and they come because they've had a lot of bad experiences. And they tell me that almost no other therapist that they've had have even talked about love and or loving one another. And, you know, just that basic idea that that's what life is about. And mm-hmm. I will go back, as it sounds like you do, and to their earliest times, and I'll say, well, did you love each other in the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Now, people, sometimes it turns out no, and then you're in a serious problem because it is kind of hard to learn to love somebody that you've been fighting with for 15 years and you didn't love in the beginning. It's more difficult. But if they loved each other in the beginning, then they're just really excited about the idea of loving each other like that again.
Yes.
And maybe even more deeply and richly because of all they've been through.
Yes.
So I bring that up again as the model in part of loving communication, the way you were in the beginning, where you loved each other and you wanted to make a good impression, you wanted to make each other happy.
Yeah. It's finding the spark. It's finding the spark,
yes.
and then going with that.
Yeah. And it's not fake. People think it's fake because it's so hard in the beginning. Mm. And I say, well, it's not fake if you love your husband and you're trying your best to not let the static and the anger and the frustration and the huge, enormous warehouse of grievances. It's not fake to try to set them aside and to get to love. That's the realest thing on earth. Love is the realest thing there is.
Oh, you got it. You got it. That's really it. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. And when I read your book and met you and then read your book, that was like, wow, this
Which
is
book
so
did
refreshing.
You read?
The newest one, Anxiety.
Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety.
Yes.
So oh, good.
When I read about how love, and I was reading the couples part, I don't have the book with me, but I remember reading about that, how it is all about love. And I'm like, wow, you know? We made this connection for a reason, because I am so much in that framework as well.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, love for all creatures, love for each other, love for animals.
Well, right? Let's talk about love for animals. I think that's very important. I learned unconditional love with my dogs, I think, starting at about age 4. Tell me about love for animals and how it fits in.
Oh, love for animals. Well, I don't know. I just was raised with all kinds of animals. Everything from mice to raccoons to dogs and cats and roosters and calves and everything. And I just, I never felt that they were different from us. You know, they're just little beings like we are. And I don't eat them. I just love them, and I just see them as unconditional love. I don't know how else to say it, just unconditional love. And that's how I think we should treat people. And if we can all just learn that lesson from the animals and transfer that to people, oh, my gosh, is it really that hard? And I don't see how hard that is. And I know that might sound so woo-woo and out there for people who aren't loving animals that way, but you transfer it to people. Do you get that?
Well, I think it's a lot easier with animals for most of us. And I think that I think that humanity may have actually begun to learn unconditional love earnestly when we began to have dogs, which is not that long ago, anywhere from, you know, 10 to maybe 50,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. Nobody's sure that we were getting close to dogs. I told you when we were talking before we got on the show, but I'm not sure I've told my audience that I finished a novel over this past summer, and it's a novel set in 20,000 B.C., and it's a kind of a boy meets girl story, but it's much bigger than that. It's about a girl in 20,000 BC who rescues a puppy when her mother is murdered. The puppy's mother is actually murdered by her father, who thinks it's a wolf. She rescues the puppy and defies the tribe, the clan, and keeps the puppy and raises the first dog that anybody's ever seen in this part of the world. And then a few years later, out walking as she does, safe, feeling safely with her now grown dog, 2 or 3 year old dog, she meets a man, a young man who has a grown dog whom he took from somebody who bought him from a trader. This man was the man who bought the dog was abusing it, and he just took it from him. Mm-hmm. And so they both care about animals, and the animals provide them the context for daring to love, because they're both loners. And the animals actually show them, in many ways, how to love. And then they start breeding the animals they get married, and they breed the animals, their two dogs, and develop a large number of dogs that greatly influence the entire course of this family of 25 or 30 people. And I use it as how I think that civilization may have been sparked by our experience with dogs, not just for hunting and protecting us and guarding us, but for loving us. And I think this is a great, wonderful book, just as the story goes. There's one paragraph about it, but I haven't been able to get an agent interested or a publisher interested. You know, Peter Bregan is the guy who writes the critical stuff about psychiatry and occasionally some good psychology as well. So anybody out there knows an agent who might be interested in a book that I think could be a huge bestseller and a great movie, give me a call, will you?
Yeah, don't give up on that one.
No, I don't want to give up on that one. But dogs played a very big role in my life. I remember the Irish setter that we had when I was born. I think I was a couple of years old when my family noticed that I seemed to be hugging the Irish setter more than I was hugging the rest of the family. I think one of my dearest companion for much of my childhood later on was a very large dog that was larger than a shepherd and was black and maybe had some lab in him. And he and I were very close. And I learned the importance of treating beings with love in part from my relationship with the dog. So dogs played a very big role for me. And I think they do for a lot of people growing up.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they're the best parents. You know, all animals are the best parents, aren't they?
We could just take they're very devoted, and they know what to do, and they don't bite or hurt their offspring, and they defend them. And I mean, yes, I hadn't thought about it in those terms. That could be a part of the book about what good parents they are. I think that's a very important observation. Now, did you grow up on a farm? It sounds like it. And a lot of people have terrible experiences with animals on farms because they see them getting shot. They see them getting abused. And what was your experience?
So I grew up in the country with a lot of animals, but not on a dairy farm or anything like that. It was more dogs and cats, and we had a rooster, and we had a skunk, and we had a rook raccoon, and we had mice and hamsters and gerbils. So it was that kind of farm. And I did have, my dad did, when I was like 12, have two calves that, and we had a horse too, we had horses. And I named them Eddie and Steve. By the farmers that we got them from. And I didn't know it at the time, but my dad bought them to, you know, raise and then give them back to the farmer for, I guess, veal or something. And I didn't know that at the time. But so that's as close as to the farm thing we got. But I had no idea. I just thought, wow, we got these two cute little calves, and I spent time with them and talked to them. And those are my friends, because I lived out in the country, and my friends were all these animals. And I grew a very deep connection with them and learned a lot about love through the animals. Absolutely.
How did you respond when the animals were taken off for the slaughter?
Oh, well, I didn't ask any questions. I just, as a child, just thought, well, okay, I guess we had them and now we don't. And I always wondered, but I never asked. But
so
I think a lot of people are like
later.
That. Yes, yes, yes. And I wrote a blog post recently, and it's published on a vegan blog site, Badass Cookie Company, actually. And I talk about living in the meat matrix. So if anybody's interested in that, I write a lot about being a vegan and what that means in emotional wellness as well.
Tell us about that. Tell us how you got to be a vegan, what it does for you. And I gather you encourage your clients to go in that direction somewhat. Well, tell
us
about that.
Yes, I'm very careful about that. They know I am because I talk about it in my book, and it comes up in casual conversation. And if they want to talk about health and wellness, because I'm a holistic therapist and I'm also a health coach, then that is the route I am going, as a plant-based diet. But how I got there was, well, number one, being raised to love animals and how it began. But then one day my husband and I went to Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen. Are you familiar with Farm Sanctuary?
No.
So it's in Watkins Glen, and it's a farm that rescues, takes in abused farm animals. And they're very, very large. They have one in California, New York, and I think in another state. I can't remember which state that is. But I learned all about what happens to the animals in the name of our food. And that's all I needed to know. That's it. It traumatized me, and I was planning on going to Burger King after that. My husband and I were like, yeah, let's go to Farm Sanctuary, and then we'll go to Burger King. Well, we became vegetarians that day forward, and that was 1991. And then when I became a health coach, like I mentioned earlier in my story, then I transitioned into a vegan lifestyle. I wanted to anyway. That was just the kick and transition I needed to help me to do that, to know how to do that effectively. So I've been a vegan for 7 years now. And just to clarify for your listeners, what that is a vegan doesn't eat or use animal products. So that means nothing with a mother, in other words. So, and no leather or wool or anything like that. Just don't use them at all.
When you're on a vegan lifestyle, a vegan diet, vegan eating way of life, are there risks entailed there on missing any nutrients? Because it's my understanding that we've never found a society that didn't do some supplemental meat.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work out? Because there's now a lot of experience in the world with vegan eating. How is that turning out in terms of missing anything in particular?
Yeah, so that is very encouraging. And people are learning more and more that it's very natural and healthy, and actually the healthiest. So, for example, learning things like B12 is one of the things that people get all, hyped up about. You got to have B12, and you can't have B12 unless you eat meat. Well, what they don't know is, and what I didn't know either, was that how we get B12 is actually from the soil that the cows eat. So the cows are ingesting the soil, and it's getting into their bodies, and then we eat their bodies. So we just definitely need B12, but we don't need the animal to get it. So you can supplement. Years and years ago, they used to get it in farming with the deep soiled vegetables. But nowadays, as you may know, it's not like that anymore. Our food isn't the same agriculturally as it was a million years ago when it was soil nutrient. So now we do have to supplement some things, and B12 is one of them. So that's and protein. Well, that's always the big joke. Where do you get your protein? So, there's definitely protein, lots of it, in many different leafy greens and all kind, everything has protein, basically. You can't not get it in all kinds of vegetables and things. So then there's beans and legumes and tofu and tempeh. And it's like more about what don't I eat? People, what do you eat? It's like, what don't I eat? That's an easier question. So, but
it has
I love
a face.
About
I don't
that.
Eat it.
Yes, yes. And I think I'm pretty healthy and in my 50th decade, and I helped my mom. A lot of things I talk about in my book too is why I wanted to talk about nutrition in my with my clients is because not only did I see my clients not healthy, but I saw my family members starting. My dad had terrible arthritis and other health conditions, and my mom was struggling with arthritis too, and diabetes. My dad had type 1 diabetes, and my sister died of brain cancer, and then I started to get scared, and I started to want to learn more and more about health, and I wish I knew then what I know now, because luckily my mom's still alive. And I do use what I know now to help her get really healthy, and she's going strong in her 80th decade. So food and mood, the food-mood connection. So that's very important for me.
Have you come across Pam Popper, who is very big in the vegetable-based diet?
Yes.
In the country?
Yes, I know Pam. I don't know Pam Popper, but I definitely follow her, and I learn a lot from her, yes.
I spent much of last weekend with Pam. She came to visit me with Dell, her cook that she works with and builds her programs with. You might get in touch with Pam. She welcomes new voices in her life, and she's just a wonderful human being, and she's trying to build a whole, she is building a whole college and potentially a university around healthier approaches. And I'm going to be working with her around the mental health side of it, which will be new for her group. But I did speak to her group a couple of years ago, but she hasn't been doing programs for mental health. She's been doing the, except as indirectly, you know, improving your diet. Mm-hmm. Helps mental health in general. So a lot of folks are from my audience, who many of whom will know more about this perhaps than I do, but there is a huge movement going on now connecting healthy nutrition, healthy lifestyle to a healthy mind and a healthy spirit, mm-hmm. trying to bring together a lot of different approaches around this, and I think that it's I don't think any harm can come from this, and I think a lot of good can come from it. I had on the air just a few weeks ago Kelly Brogan, who is a New York City psychiatrist who's moved in that direction. She's anti-drug as I am, and she's also moving in the direction, as I have not in particular, of this kind of a broad based health approach. I think it's a very good thing.
Yes, and I'm familiar with that name too. I follow her work as well. So yes, it's growing. It's exciting.
Have you got some bigger ideas for the future, or are you going to be content to be a therapist who writes good books and helps people?
Well, I do, actually. I wrote my book, and now I'm creating programs based on my book because I have a very active private practice. But, you know, that is local people. So I definitely want to reach more people outside my local area, so I'm creating online programs based on my book, and we'll be adding all kinds of you can hear my kitty cat crying there. I'm going to be adding all kinds of exciting programs that you can do online, so you can reach me, not just here if you're local, but anywhere. So that's what I'm working on now. And I already do online sessions. I already do work with people one-on-one online, but I just want to create programs to reach a bigger number. and help as many people as I can.
Have you read any of another friend of mine, Jeffrey Mason, M-A-S-S-O-N, his books on animals, and he's got a book on what farm life is like?
No, now that one I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, Jeffrey Musief Mason. A lot of people I admire and love are vegetarians, and I frankly consider it a moral, spiritual failing that I've never become a vegetarian.
Oh no!
I think you know. I do consider it a moral failing. I think if my wife Ginger has such a huge influence on how I live in a positive way, if she were a vegetarian, I'd be a vegetarian.
Well,
I do think that it's something that that I really understand and believe in, but have just not managed to do with all the other things that I'm obviously doing. But the more I hear, maybe one of these days I'm just going to announce, hey, Ginger, I'm now a vegetarian.
Well, my reaction when you said that about the moral, I actually wanted to say that for me, it is a spiritual piece. It is moral for me. It is a spiritual piece. But I don't want you to beat yourself up for it. But you're absolutely right. And that is actually what feeds my spirit. And it does have a strong moral component. But I don't want you to beat yourself up for it. But I do want you to consider exploring it. And I'll be right here if you need me to do that, because that's what I love.
Well, I'm afraid I'll have to get through Ginger first. And I actually think it'd be good for her. She's probably be mad at me for talking this way a little bit. Not mad, just make her a little nervous. But yes, I think that so many things that are out there are really good, and things that I haven't done. I think meditation. I pray. My form of meditation is I pray. I don't know what your views are on God, but I really believe that God is active in our lives, and a lot of my spiritual life centers around that concept that the work I do is for a purpose, that I was trained to do it without knowing it. Ginger holds very strongly to the view that God spent the first 35 years preparing her to help me in this work that we do.
Wow.
Because she got enormous training that is helpful in the work that we do, that I do. Well, look, we're coming to the end. Folks, say goodbye to Peg Haust Arliss, her book, Anxiety Breakthrough. It's been great to interview you, Peg. Just wonderful.
Thank you so much.